Grazie, né? Please join me for the refuge and precepts. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami. Sangham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Dutiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi buddham saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami. Tatiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Please join me for the precepts. Panyatipada Brahmani Sikapadam Samadhiyami Adinadana Brahmani Sikapadam Samadhiyami Kamesu Michachara Brahmani Sikapadam Samadhiyami Musa Vada Brahmani Sikapadam Samadhiyami Sura Maria Pamatana I undertake the precepts to refrain from sources of livelihood that bring harm to other beings. I undertake the precept to refrain from acting out of ill will or taking satisfaction in the misfortune of others. I undertake the precept to be open-hearted and generous in all my relationships with others. I undertake the precept to act with loving kindness and compassion in all my relationships with others. I undertake the precept to live with mindfulness and to follow the Eightfold Path through daily study, meditation, and reflection. With these 10 precepts, virtue becomes the vehicle for a happy existence. Through virtue, good fortune is attained. Virtue is the vehicle for liberation. Let us purify our virtue. We dedicate the merit accumulated here today to the benefit of all beings. By this deed, may all beings come to know the pure world, free from suffering. And please join me. May all beings be free from suffering. May all beings be free from ill will. May all beings be filled with loving kindness. May all beings be truly happy. Thank you. Okay. So, as always, got lots of questions. So the first one I'll begin with here is, I like to start with the easy ones first. Yeah. When I started studying with you, I was at a point where book study did not appeal. How was I to know truth from distortion? That's really a good question. Especially when to test it seemed impossible in many cases, or would take too long. Now I feel grounded in my own meditative experiences and ready to start studying again. Where should I start? Do you have a reading list, a Dharma class series? It would save me much time, I think. On the Dharma Treasure website, there is a recommended reading list, which whenever I find the time, I add to and provide a little more information about the books that are already there. And there is a Dharma study course that was extended over a series of Thursdays over more than the last year, and all of the recordings from that are available on the website as well. And with any luck, at some point, there may be transcriptions of those talks available that could get edited and make something they could read. In the meantime, though, especially if you're in a situation where you do a lot of driving, you can listen to them while you commute. One part of his question, though, is how was I to know truth from distortion, especially when to test it seemed impossible in many cases? And that's a very important point. the Buddha did provide some guidelines about, you know, he was asked at different times by people, you know, we hear all these different versions of things. How are we supposed to know what's true, what's not, what's worth paying attention to or not? And basically, he started out by making a fairly simple, and it may seem like an obvious distinction, is that any teaching that is beneficial for you, makes you a better person, that following that teaching is beneficial to those around you, and helpful to those around you, then that's a teaching that you should consider as potentially useful and valid. Any teaching that doesn't have that effect, that causes you more harm or suffering, or causes any of those around you any kind of harm or suffering, should be discarded. And I think that that's kind of an obvious distinction, but it's not so obvious. I mean, you look at the belief systems that many people hold in the world today, and by that criteria, they should have dropped that belief system a long time ago, like a hot potato. Right? Belief systems that encourage judgmental attitudes and intolerance and punishment and so on and so forth definitely don't fit into that criteria. Which most Dharma teachings don't fall into that category. So they're pretty beneficial in one way or another to the person that practices them and to the people around that person. Another criteria is that it should make sense to you. It should be understandable. And it's very easy for somebody to use verbal logic in such a way that they present something to you, it just sounds really reasonable. But the logic they use may be flawed, the assumptions that they begin their discussion with may be flawed. One of the ways to measure the quality of the instruction you've received from somebody else is, can you in turn explain it? Can you explain it to yourself afterwards in your own words? Or could you explain it to somebody else who wasn't present to hear the teaching in a way that makes sense to them and is reasonable to them? And that's a good sign. If you can't, of course, it's always possible that you didn't quite understand it, or you forgot some point, or things like that. But anytime you read or hear a teaching and you find it difficult to follow that particular chain of logic afterwards, or you find it difficult to explain it to somebody else in such a way that says, oh yeah, I see the point of that, then you need to question it. Because it's just a fact of the way language is. I learned about this when I was in a seminary many years ago, the distinction between verbal logic and what you might call formal logic. Words lend themselves to being used in a way that they sound logical, but if you convert them into the symbols of formal logic, you all of a sudden see that they don't make any sense at all. You know, they're full of contradictions, or they go in circles. That's another thing, that in verbal logic, a lot of things get explained in a circular manner. So they don't really explain anything at all. They just end up back where they started and say, see? So it's very important that when you receive a teaching, that you be able to understand it. And don't be too quick to doubt yourself. People who are very adept at presenting things in a convincing way using verbal logic, they're usually pretty bright people. And they can create the impression that, well, the reason I don't understand this is I'm not as smart as she is, or I'm not as smart as he is. You know, but gee, they're so smart. I guess I better believe it. You don't need to do that. Trust yourself. You got this far. And the next part of this journey is, it's too important to begin it with a lack of confidence in your own ability to discern what makes sense from what doesn't. The other thing is, it needs to fit with your experience. With your experience of yourself, with your experience of the world, with experience of other people. If you receive a teaching that asks you to, that's in contradiction with your own experience, well, it's possible that you may be putting a wrong spin on things, or you may be misinterpreting things. But don't be too quick to assume that. If that's the case, then you should be able to take your own experience, and you should be able to discern how it is that this new idea is consistent with your own experience. So it should fit with your experience of the world. It should fit with your experience both internally and with what you observe. A lot of distorted teachings that have generated a lot of suffering in the world encourage us to see others in a way that is very different than the way we see ourselves. You know, you look inside, and so if you're convinced to see something out there in a way that doesn't match what happens when you turn around and look within, then there's something wrong, and you need to question that. The other thing that's part of this is that if it's a teaching about a spiritual practice, it should work. It should produce results. Part of this was, especially when to test it seemed impossible in many cases or would take too long. What the Buddha is basically saying is, life is short. You don't have time to waste on things that promise a result way down the road, but don't give you any immediate demonstration that you're getting closer to where you want to be. So it should be testable. And that's what the Buddha said of his teaching. Come and see for yourself. He said, don't believe anything I say. Don't take it on my authority. Don't believe it because all these other people believe what I say. Satisfy yourself by doing it, testing it. And this was the thing. Everything he taught was something that you could try out. You could apply for yourself. You could satisfy yourself that it was true. You know, in his very first teaching on the Four Noble Truths, one thing about the way the Four Noble Truths are usually summarized is it leaves out the part in that sutra where after he described the truth, he told you how you could explore yourself and satisfy yourself that this was true. And this was really the place that he came from in his teaching. As he said, this Dharma is good in the beginning, it's good in the middle, and it's good in the end. And so if you follow a set of instructions properly, then you should see within a reasonable period of time, and you do need to make the effort, you do need to follow the instructions, you do need to test it, you know, you do need to test it, no question about that. But if you've tested it, and if you put in the effort, and you don't see it producing the kind of results, and in this case, these results are in the form of making you a better person, of somehow having more success in the practice that you're doing, you can't see that it's making any difference. You don't have time for it. You should look for something else. You should check it out. The one other criteria that he mentioned when people addressed this was authority, scriptural authority. Now the fact is that a truth that has, or a teaching that has stood the test of time, that has been accepted and comes down to us in the form of scriptures, tends to be more reliable than something new. But this is the least valuable criterion by which to judge any teaching or new information. Of course, Buddha was going to say that. After all, he was teaching things that were very different than what had come down in the scriptures at that point. But we can acknowledge that there is something to be said for the test of time. If wise men have found truth and value in something, and this has happened repeatedly, then it's a good starting place. But you don't want to put too much reliance on that. Just because an idea has been around a long time doesn't mean it's true. The idea that the world might be round took a long time to settle in. The idea that the earth might go around the sun rather than vice versa got Galileo into some deep trouble. Right? So you can't trust something because it's in sacred scriptures or the commentaries to sacred scriptures and so on and so forth. This brings it back to, you have to test it by reason, you have to test it by experience, and you have to test it by whether or not when you follow the teaching it actually produces the result that it's supposed to teach, to produce. But when you're confronted with a whole bunch of material, of course it makes sense to start with more solid traditional teachings. Gives you a sound basis to begin with. Keep in mind though, every dogma, every teaching at some point becomes fossilized into dogma. And tends to get institutionalized. And then there's the teachers who are the experts in this teaching. And at some point, I mean, this is true of lineages, you know, put so much value on lineages. At some point, no matter what form it takes, the institution, the lineage, the school, whatever, it kind of fossilizes, and the teachers of the dogma and their authority and the respect that's afforded them and everything else, that becomes more important than the content of the teaching. And so the institution and the teachers are defending themselves and their future. And long ago, some cases centuries ago, any pursuit of truth got lost. And so I have to keep that in mind. The other thing about lineages is their value is that they preserve things. But they can preserve errors and misunderstandings just as effectively as they can preserve truth. And so you need to keep that in mind. So, putting it back to the person that asked the question, in the pursuit of teachings, ultimately the responsibility comes back upon you. And that's a good thing. That's a really important thing. But these are the tools that you have to work with. Your own mind, your own experience, testing it through trying it, see if it produces the desirable results. And of course, that very basic starting point is that where it leads should be a place that is a benefit to you and to everyone around you. So hopefully that answers that question reasonably well. But yeah, there's a reading list and there's lots of recorded material on the website. I spent a lot of time talking, and I just really love to see the day that someone, and I don't think it's probably not going to be me, but someone organizes that material to make it easier to find what you're interested in, and maybe puts it in other forms so that so that rather than just listening to it on your iPod or whatever, you could also read it. That's a goal. Okay. Someone asks, would you explain what purification means in your worldview? Well, I'd love to. See, the problems that we have ways of seeing things, ways of behaving, patterns of reaction to certain kinds of situations that trigger certain kinds of speech and behavior. The way that certain kinds of events trigger certain emotions and thought patterns. And where did those come from? They've come from your past experience. Many of them from your childhood, but certainly not restricted to that. Adolescence is a period where we get programmed into a lot of ways of seeing things and reacting to things that some may be good, some may be bad. The good ones you don't need to be purified of so much. But the bad ones are creating problems for you. And the way that I think of this is there is a part of your mind that learned through experience sometime in your life to produce a particular kind of reaction, emotional and otherwise, in response to a certain kind of triggering events. And that probably happened. You have that programming in that part of your mind, because whatever created it in the first place, this response worked at that time. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's still appropriate or works now. But we have all this hidden stuff. And it's a lot of what we call our personality. Some of these personality characteristics are good, and some of these personality characteristics are not so good. We'd be better off without them. But we, in many cases, we don't even know they're there. And even if we know they're there, we don't necessarily know where they came from. And even if we can trace it back enough to say that, you know, well, I'm probably like this because this is what happened to me when I was growing up, and it made me this way. But we don't know what to do about them. And don't know how to change them. And this is one of the kinds of things that we need to purify. And this is what mindfulness does. Mindfulness brings about this kind of purification. As you become more mindful, what you'll see is that in some particular situation, you'll have this reaction. It'll be a reaction, a kind of reaction that you've had many times before. It's one of those things that, well, it's just the way I am. Whenever this happens, it always affects me the same way. I always react the same way. And you probably even agree, and yeah, it's a big problem, and I wish I didn't do that, but I don't know how to change it. Through mindfulness, though, you begin to be able to hold that in your consciousness for a longer period of time. Rather than doing what you've always done before, which is you want to forget about it as soon as possible, or even more likely, you forget about it by distracting yourself, thinking of something else. Or sometimes you don't even have to think of something else to distract you. You get so busy trying to clean up the mess you've made afterwards that that's distraction enough. Or you make excuses, you rationalize it, you know, of course, you know. You don't tend to notice how much suffering that it's causing you. Whereas if you become mindful, you start to see all of these things. You start to see that indeed, instead of distracting yourself, you continue to observe the consequences of what you've done. And you see the harm that they cause you, and you hold that in consciousness. An interesting thing happens when you do this. See, there's some part of your mind with a particular program. The initiating event acts as a trigger. The program ran, you did the thing, then you get into the distraction or the rationalization or some other phase, and that part of your mind goes to sleep, and it doesn't see what the results are. But the only reason that part of your mind does this thing is because it believes it's good for you. It just doesn't stay tuned in long enough to find out that it's not. So mindfulness allows you to see that it's not. And this allows for kind of purification to take place. When you honestly, frankly, non-judgmentally, you know, not getting into guilt and self-recrimination, because those are just other distractions that keep you from seeing what's really happening. But when you just hold it in consciousness and you allow yourself to actually observe the consequences of your way of reaction, it sends a message to the source, and that message kind of forces that part of your mind to start reprogramming the way you respond. It would take a very long time for, you have to wait till that kind of situation arises to, and you have to be mindful when it arises to set this process in motion. And then very often it has to be repeated quite a few times where you're in the same situation with mindfulness, that your mindfulness allows you to, it brings about this change and you gradually stop reacting in the same way. It would take a long time, you know, 10,000 lifetimes or something, to clean up all the mess you've accumulated over the course of your life up to this point, to do it that way. There's another more important kind of purification that happens in meditation, and that's mostly what I talk about when I speak of purification, is where the deeper roots of these patterns of behavior emerge, and you are able to purify them. All of these different parts of yourself that contribute to the unfortunate aspects of your personality and your ways of handling situations, they're all interconnected, and they all evolved in time together. So when some of the deeper roots of these come up in meditation and you have the opportunity to confront them and accept them and integrate them, it does the work of thousands of instances of practicing mindfulness in daily life in a very short time. It works the same way. Something comes up in consciousness, and rather than hiding from it or suppressing it, resisting it, you accept it and you confront it and you allow it to be there. You come from a place of acceptance. And the more you accept it, the more of the other things that are connected to it will come to the surface. And the important thing that happens while you're doing this is that you never forget where you are. The terrible things that happen to you at other stages in your life. If you're somebody that's carrying around the residue of some military service in some combat situation, whether it was some kind of traumatic events or series of events, or something that might even seem comparatively minor by itself, except that it got repeated daily and weekly for a long period of your life, that made a powerful imprint. A single very traumatic event, multiple events, all kinds of different forms it can take. But when these roots of these patterns of behavior come to the surface and you examine them objectively while at the same time never losing track of where you are and who you are now, if it comes up in meditation, you're usually sitting in a very comfortable, safe place, often surrounded by a bunch of really wonderful people. And not only that, the person who happens to be sitting in meditation is by no means the same person that these events happen to. And so when you're able to confront the emotions and the memories and so on and so forth that come up, that's how they get integrated. You're holding them in consciousness, and at the same time, you know where you are and who you are and what you're doing, rather than getting lost in these things. If you get lost in them and you just relive the old stuff, or you get swept up by the same old emotions that they always produce, nothing's going to happen. It's not going to produce any beneficial effect. But if you're mindful, if you're present while you are allowing these things to come up, a process of integration takes place. And these traumatic events that have been driving certain kinds of behaviors and emotions and everything else for all of these many years. There's a process of you accept them, you see them, you don't forget who and what you are now, and they get integrated and they lose the power that they once had. And this terribly traumatic event from the past that you may not have thought of for years, but it's always been there, simmering away in the background. It becomes just something that happened. It's just another piece of history. And the fact that you may have reacted in a particular way at that time that was helpful in the sense that perhaps eased your suffering at the time or spared you further suffering at the time or so on and so forth, that no longer applies. And so you are no longer driven to react in a similar way when events in the present arise that would otherwise act as triggers. So when these deep things come up in meditation, you're removing a whole lot of the problem at once. Yes?
Can you bring them up? I mean, if you know that there's something there or things there that, you know, are troubling you and they don't come up, can you bring them up?
Well, it's best not to do that, but you can. You see, the trouble is when you try to bring them up, you're not really, what you're bringing up is a story about them. And you've probably brought them up other times before. You may even have sat in a counselor or therapist's office and brought them up. But if they come up in a way that the thing you need to purify is here and the story is here, you know, it doesn't work too well. Because then you just have to somehow get through the story. This doesn't mean that you can't get through the story. If you were in a counselor or therapist's office and it worked, they would help you to work your way through the story to get to the thing, if it's successful. A better approach is to give them permission, invite these things to come up, but don't go digging for them. And in particularly in stage 4 meditation, but also in stage 7, your mind is really, really receptive to having these things come up. And in that calm and that peaceful space, they'll come to the surface and they'll peek out. They'll often peek out very shyly at first, and may not even look like what they really are. But you keep inviting them. You keep the invitation there. The attitude that, you know, you're willing to address this. You're willing to accept this. You're willing to look at it. And until it comes up. Now, if you know there's something in particular that you need to deal with, you can address your invitation specifically to that. But usually to go digging for it, you know, it's like digging for clams. You know, if they know you're after them, they go the other way. So, and sort of like a squid, that they'll throw up a smoke screen so that you think you've got what you're looking for, but I'm probably inspired to use maritime analogy.
Yeah. So if you're at like stage 4 and nothing's coming up, you know, is there any risk that you're kind of, you know, stopping distractions soon enough that they don't even... Or will they push their way up, or are you missing out if they're not coming up?
It's very important to allow subtle distractions to be there until you get to stage six, your attitude toward subtle distractions is they have total permission to be there, you just don't want them to become gross distractions. And if you get into suppressing them, then yeah, you're not going to allow the kinds of things to come up that need to be purified. I mean, there's two reasons, that's one of two reasons. The other reason is that you never want to suppress subtle distractions, ever. And for a different reason, which I'll actually explain in a few minutes. You never want to suppress subtle distractions at all. And so that's one reason that you don't, you know, if you find there's no subtle distractions in stage four, then you probably are repressing them, or you may even be like guarding your if you have the idea that you shouldn't have any subtle distractions, you may be guarding your peripheral awareness from allowing those things that are already there to become obvious. But certainly in terms of purification, you want them to be there, because that's exactly how they're going to appear. They're going to appear, usually appear as subtle distractions at first, then they become strong subtle distractions. They'll be the ones that want to become gross distractions. And they'll be the ones that are strong enough distractions that, and that's when you know it's time to take them as the focus of your attention, is when you can't just let them be and stay on the meditation object. When they intrude too strongly, then you know that's something that's ready to be looked at.
And then, so if you deliberately move your attention to them, you aren't forgetting the object, you're just changing it?
Yes, you're continuing to meditate so long as it's an intentionally chosen object that you focus your attention on. You're still meditating, and you're still training the mind. So you haven't ended the meditation, but you've made the meditation object something now that's going to be a great benefit to you to hold in attention and to examine in that way. So the proper way to do this is the object to be purified in whatever form it takes. Whether it's an emotion, a thought, a vision, a memory, you know, I mentioned vision is kind of shorthand for, sometimes what comes up is something that, it's not a memory, certainly it's nothing that's ever happened in your life, but it's, and you don't know where it comes from, but it's really disturbing, and it elicits an emotion. You know, you suddenly find yourself having images of, say, some horrible, gory thing happening. Like, where is that coming from? That's sometimes the form that these can come up in. But as I say, whether sometimes it's thoughts, like, you know, it's like, wow, where did that weird thought come from? Emotions, thoughts, memories, images, whatever form it takes, when something comes up that is strong in that way and intrusive, you make that the focus of your attention. You focus your attention fully on it. Whereas in your peripheral awareness, you never forget where you are and who you are and what you're doing. And that's the combination that leads to purification. When you get caught up in it, you forget where you are. And if that happens, then you need to back away from it. Maybe even sometimes do something else, and let it come back another time when you are maybe better prepared not to get caught by it, not to get overtaken by it. So an analogy that I use for this process, in Arizona we have a kind of thorn bush that's called cat claw, because it has long thorns that are shaped like a cat's claw, and you'd swear sometimes they reach out to snag your clothing. And it's a remarkably fast-growing shrub. tree shrub. The process of, by which mindfulness in daily life allows you to correct for certain patterns of your behavior that are troublesome and problematic is like trimming branches off of a cat claw. That's very, very helpful, you know, to get those branches out of the way. But the trouble is that new ones will, well, first of all, there's a whole lot of branches, a huge number of branches. And the other problem is that they grow back. It's not the same one that grows back, but it's new ones that are growing from the same stalk, right? A new branch grows off the same stalk again. When these things come up in meditation, it's like cutting that stalk off at the ground level. So you eliminate a whole lot of branches at once, which is much better. And of course, if you've ever seen one of these bushes, you realize that you can't really usually get to the stalk at ground level until you've already trimmed a bunch of branches. You've seen, you know, yeah. But once you've trimmed enough branches, you can get there and you can start cutting the stalk off at ground level. But the other thing is that you can cut every stalk off, and if you come back next year, new stalks will have grown out of the same roots and be producing new branches. And so that's where we get to the real roots of this. The real roots, the ones that you have to remove, are those corresponding to the craving and ignorance. That those are the real roots. And the same process of mindfulness eventually leads to eliminating the real roots. You could say that the kind of integration and resolution that happens in meditation in stage 4 and stage 7 is like cutting the stalks off at the ground level. But as long as you are still coming from a place of ignorance and delusion, as long as you're driven by craving, as long as your worldview is one of being a separate self in a world of other that depends for your safety and for your happiness on your interaction, then as long as that root is there, there's going to be new stalks grow up and new branches grow up. If the process of cutting off the stalk is seeing the initial events that set this in motion as they really are, and integrating them with the present reality that you live in, something similar happens in terms of these roots. You have insight experiences, and the insight experiences that you have a similar effect. You're seeing things as they really are, and as a result of that, you have insight, and the insight allows you to integrate a completely new understanding into your future experiences, and this is where you remove the roots, and no stalks will grow out of it. So it's the purification. This is what I mean by purification. It's the purification that comes at its simplest level when mindfulness realizes you have a choice. I don't have to do what I've always done. I could do something different. And the deeper level of purification goes when, in meditation, you get to the roots of some of these larger patterns of behavior that have driven you for so long. But then finally, the mindfulness brings you to the kinds of insights.
What's that?
Well, the battery's dying.
Battery's dying.
Yeah, okay. I'm just going to change the battery, okay?
Okay, yeah. All right. Anyway, you see where this is going. Insights serve the same purpose, but at a much deeper level. So that's what I mean by purification, all of these things. The ultimate purification is complete awakening. Any comments about that? Yeah.
I don't know if it's about that, but I kind of have this revelation because just now, just listening to you, I went all the way back to when I began to learn about Buddhism. And at that point, I was just curious. It was like I was searching for teachers. So I'd go to Thich Nhat Hanh or Sogyal Rinpoche, a retreat, you know, for a week or a weekend. And what I remember is that when I took my refuge and took the vows, and they gave them pretty easily, you know, it seemed to people there like there were 1,000 people at Thich Nhat Hanh arrived at that. I started to cry. I mean, I was just really totally emotional. And to me, just listening to you, this first purification, I haven't cried since maybe about like that. I mean, maybe something in my life or watching a movie or reading a book or listening to some music or something, but it happened to everybody. All the first timers had this release, and then if you go to another retreat, it was all the new ones. They were just, you know, it's like that thing. Now it's real just coming back. It was pretty powerful, and, you know, I've had some struggles since then, but it really meant something, and I couldn't just go back to that. And also relate to many, many other people. It was an opening for them, and a way of saying, you know, this is the way. This is something for me. I can work with.
Thank you. Anything else?
Yeah. If you're having an arising in your daily life that's needs to be purified, does that necessarily mean that you're at one of the particular stages?
No, the kind of purification that happens in daily life, it just means that you have enough mindfulness to truly be present in a non-judgmental way and without being overtaken by your usual reactions. Although I should mention that you can have a really powerful purification similar to what arises in meditation in daily life. If you've somehow been primed for it, if you come to the right place, you know, it can be something that goes beyond just the present situation. You know, you can see how, oh my gosh, this is a pattern that's been happening my whole life in all these different ways, and I see this goes all the way back to my relationship with my mother, you know, I mean, something like that, right? So that's similar to the kind of thing that happens in meditation. It can't happen in daily life. But as soon as a person develops enough mindfulness that they begin to spontaneously be mindful of what they're doing in their daily life, then they start to have that kind of purification.
And it can happen anywhere along the way.
You know, and even if you just happen by accident on a particular occasion to have enough mindfulness, which basically means you didn't get so totally lost in your habitual conditioned reactions that you remained fully conscious of what was going on. Actually, just along the same lines of that, insight experiences and insights don't just happen in meditation either. Once your mind is adequately prepared, once you have the kind of mindfulness, an insight experience is nothing more than experience where you see, where a greater truth that's in conflict with your suppositions, with the view that you hold of the way things are, when it makes itself apparent, so that now there's a conflict between the way things really are and the way that you thought they were, that's an insight experience. And these are actually happening all the time, because in every moment, ultimate truth is always present. And so in any moment, at any time, that there could your ability to protect the view that you hold by not looking too closely at that truth, at reality, it can break down. And when it does, you have an insight experience, which you can either blow off and disregard, or run away and hide from, or something like that. Or you can see it and understand it for what it's really telling you, in which case there'll be some deep reprogramming of your mind take place. And so this can happen at any time, in meditation, out of meditation. And meditation is going to prepare your mind so that this becomes more possible. It's just that in meditation, especially in a deep state of meditation, and doing particular practices as well, that's conducive to really massively powerful insight experiences. That's one of the differences there. But insights can happen at any time, including insights that result in stream entry.
Are they more powerful in meditation because you have more sub-minds attending, because you're more aware, or is it because
there are a whole variety of different reasons why. One of the things, though, is in particularly in more advanced stages and in deep states of meditation, where you're closely observing your own mind, this process puts you in a position to see major discrepancies. That when your eyes are open, you're walking around in the world, you're a little bit too preoccupied. You don't have the powerful introspective awareness. You don't have the stability of attention. You don't have the other qualities that, at least you don't have them to the same degree that you do when you're in meditation. But that's just one. There's a lot of different things. Some practices, deliberately, you're coaxing the mind into, you know, the practice has been designed by somebody who knows that if you do this, you're likely to have a direct experience of something that you wouldn't ordinarily see. And at meditation, it allows that to happen. There's a lot of practices that are specifically designed to lead to insight into impermanence. And just to clarify, impermanence doesn't mean that things don't last. The radical impermanence we're talking about is that there are no things, there's only process. But there's certain practices that lead you to the point where, because of the way you're observing what's arising and passing away in your mind, that you're very, very likely to have an experience of exactly that, that there are no things, there's only an endless arising and passing away, that eventually, even the terms arising and passing away, this is a perception that's a step before insight into impermanence. Is the arising and passing away eventually dissolves into the realization that there is only process. You know, there's no, in the idea of arising and passing away, there's the arising and then there's being, and then there's the passing away, right? And eventually, what you see is there is no being. And then you see, well, actually, there's no rising and passing away either. There's just a changing, 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 followed by changing and more changing. So certain practices just coax your mind into a place where all of a sudden that becomes obvious. And others, there's other practices that coax your mind into the place where suddenly you realize that everything that appeared real to you was actually just a fabrication of your mind. And that none of those fabrications were actually in themselves the source of the material out of which the fabrication was created. And when that happens, then you have an insight into emptiness. So different practices are designed to they're the kinds of things that you need to be in a pretty deep state of meditation and in one of the higher stages of samatha in order to have just the right conditions come together. But when it does, it's a really powerful experience. It's a really immediate experience. And you have a deep realization as a result of it. Sometimes, too, insights come about. A lot of small insights add up to a huge insight. And that's why people can become awakened who are definitely not at an advanced stage of meditation. People who are just beginners at meditation can have the most powerful of all possible insights. People who have never meditated for a moment in their life or even thought about it, this happens pretty rarely, but it can happen. Insight is not restricted to deep meditative states. They're just, deep meditative states are conducive to it. What is necessary is that the mind, that just the right conditions need to come together in the mind. And all of the meditation practice, everything that I'm teaching you, is helping to create the right conditions in your mind. And as those conditions become more typical of the ongoing state of your mind, then you're more likely to experience insights in meditation or outside of meditation. And smaller insights generally, quite predictably, lead to more major insights. So that's the deepest level of purification, insight. And another thing I could say about insights is that we can make a distinction between mundane and super mundane insights. So a lot of the things that happen in the purification process that we talked about earlier would fit into the category of mundane insights. A mundane insight, what makes it mundane is that you still are sharing the same fundamental worldview that everyone else around you has and that you've always had up to that point, which means you're still seeing yourself as separate in a world of other, and you understand happiness and suffering in terms of self and other. A super mundane insight is one that causes a shift in your worldview that in which you are now seeing things in a way that's distinctly different than you did before and distinctly different than the way everybody else in the world. And that's what makes a mundane insight mundane, is it's still within the worldly paradigm of seeing how things are. But those are very, very powerful. Those mundane insights are helping to clear the way to super mundane insights. It's turning away the branches and the stalks that allow you to get to the root. Somebody asks, can you please discuss dharmic causality? And funny part of the question, whose will is being exercised at this level of causality? Oh yes, whose will? Well, you see, this highest level of causality is, that's the level of ultimate truth. And all of these other, the four preceding levels of causality are levels of causality that we might describe as relative truth. They represent, they are couched in terms of the kinds of conceptual models that the unawakened mind uses to produce a worldview and to as a basis for acting in the world. That's what makes them relative, because they're relative. They're mental constructs. They're very useful mental constructs. They're mental constructs that approach being a valid description of ultimate truth. But they're not there yet. So in terms of causality, we perceive the world in the way that we do, and by studying it, we can come up with the laws of physics and chemistry. And so that level of causality, it's a relative level of causality, because it's dependent upon models that we make of how we think things work. And it's an interesting thing until, I don't even know, I'm not sure how long ago, but certainly not much more than a century ago. Life was a mystery. Many people were fond of believing that there existed some kind of vital force, something that was separate, and it came into matter to make something alive. When something died, that this vital force left. They even used very, very careful measuring devices to see if they could measure the difference in weight of an animal between when it was still alive and when it was dead. All kinds of attempts. And of course what happened is that our ability to unravel things allowed us to develop to see that life could be explained entirely in the same kinds of ways that we had learned to describe physics and chemistry. Right? And what's been happening more and more in the last 100 years, last 50 years especially, even much more so in the last 20 years, is we're beginning to see how the phenomenon of mind, psychology, mental activity is also can be understood in similar terms. And perhaps, you know, it's amazing that such an understanding of karmic causality could have been so well developed so long ago. But certainly now, with our modern tools and our modern approaches, we're beginning to see how there's that continuity. Dharmic causality, though, is, in a sense, it holds the answers to all of the questions that can never be answered on the level of any of these other forms of causality. the why questions. Why is this something rather than nothing? And all of those kinds of things. And only the minds of Buddhas really capable of carrying out a strong inference on the laws of Dharma causality. But this is the role of Buddhas, is to somehow translate that as best they can into descriptions that everybody else can see. But Dharma causality holds the answers to, you know, it holds the answers to the questions that we're not even capable of asking. It's the ultimate why of everything and anything. And as far as whose will is being exercised at this level of causality, we can't answer that question from the level of conceptual thinking. But some of the things that we think about and talk about are approaching that. Another one of the questions that has been tossed up here a few times is what about God? You know, what is God? Who is God? Things like that. I think that what we find is in every spiritual path, no matter what conceptual models it uses, to the degree that it is a genuine, valid spiritual path, it is approaching the recognition of the same dharmic level of causality. It just goes by different names. In the history of God, God has gone through a lot of different incarnations. You know, one of the ones that most of us understood to some degree as children is like the one in the Sistine Chapel, the bearded figure with the finger. But the concept of God, first of all, as described by mystics who have followed a spiritual path to a degree of realization of truth at this level, but then also by very serious thinkers who have been able to escape somewhat the chains of dogma in Judaism and Christianity and Islam, have come up with descriptions of God that are totally compatible with the kinds of descriptions that we would get of ultimate truth from the point of view of Buddhism, or for that matter, ultimate truth from the point of view of non-dual Vedanta, Advaita, or for that matter, many other spiritual paths. I think every spiritual path has at its core the same process and the same purpose and the same goal. And those who have followed those paths, no matter which particular tradition that they came from, are recognizing the same thing. If you follow any of these paths, you're going to end up in the same place. If there is an ultimate truth, then every path, no matter how circuitous it may be, has to eventually arrive in the same place. And you can think of this as a mountain. There's many different sides to the mountain, but the view, there's only one top of the mountain, and the view from the top is the same. It doesn't matter which side you climb. But the difference is that we see in all of these different spiritual paths. And I like to distinguish between spiritual paths and religions, because religions don't really lead to the top of the mountain. The purpose of religions is to create stable social structures and to satisfy the needs of the people. And well, that was another thing somebody put in a question. I'd made some comment about religion is the opiate of the masses. I didn't come up with that, by the way. Because this is the function of religions, is to give people belief systems that make them behave reasonably well and feel more comfortable and, you know, ease some of the pain. As an analgesic or as a narcotic to take some of the sting away. But every spiritual path is climbing the same mountain. Every religion has us at its core. No matter how deeply hidden it is, it has a spiritual path. And that's what allows the religion to really to stand on its own. But the religion is quite different than the spiritual path. But every spiritual path is going the same place. And it's like trails up the different sides of the mountain. And the closer you get to the top, the more everything starts to look the same. The farther down you are, the more totally different it is. You know, if you're in the foothills of this side of the mountain, and you're in the foothills of this side of the mountain, and you're talking to each other by radio, and, you know, everything this guy says, no, you're totally wrong. It's not like that at all. And I know, I'm here, I'm looking at it, I can see it. And you're all telling the truth. And the mountain is it's the conceptual mountain, and the conceptual frameworks that we create to climb the different sides of the mountain. You know, like the idea of God, and like the idea of nirvana, suchness, dharmakaya, emptiness, all these other things, these terms that we use, you would have some people who are only partway up the Buddhist mountain who would insist that there is, it is no God. Well, if they're thinking of the guy on the Sistine Chapel, you know, you'd have to agree with them. But if they're talking about the God that they Christian or Jewish mystics talk about, or if they're talking about the God that the most sophisticated thinkers in the theological traditions that these traditions are talking about, then that would not be a true statement, because they're just different names, different labels for the same thing. Yeah.
Is there an explanation in the teachings where the goal seems to be to be enlightened, but most of us seem to be mixed up? Is there an explanation? Most of us seem to be mixed up. Uh-huh. And there seem to be very few enlightened beings, mm-hmm. in at least in this life. Is there an explanation why, when that's the goal, why most of us seem to be mixed up?
Well, yeah, there's a number of explanations. But it's interesting that Buddhism started out as a path to the top of the mountain, and there was no religion associated with it at all. On the other hand, you look at the history of Christianity, for example, and you see that it's throughout most of its history, it's really pushed aside and minimalized and ignored the true spiritual path that's trying to reach the the top of the mountain. It's no wonder that we're all, you know, we're all so mixed up and confused, because we're rarely spoken to in terms of what the ultimate goal or ultimate path is. And then when we are, it's put in different terms. But, like for example, in Christian terms, the ultimate goal is not to die and go to heaven and live in heaven forever and ever. The ultimate goal in Christianity, in mystical Christianity, is to achieve union with God immediately in this life, not after you die. And it doesn't, none of those descriptions hold any kind of image of a separate you, you know, whether it's in a beautiful body with wings or whether it's in some version of the body, you know, living in heaven. No, the mystical union with God is really described in the same terms as a kind of ultimate realization of a Buddhahood. Now, the Buddha described it as awakening. I should point out to you that enlightenment, such a common term, isn't a term that there's, it doesn't even have a word corresponding to it in Pali. Because Buddha means awakened one, and Buddha means to awaken. And so the words that it's expressed is the idea, it's like awaking from a dream, awaking to reality from a dream. It's waking up. And what it means to wake up is very similar to what it means to achieve union with God. But how many times in the course of your life has anybody offered to you as the primary goal and purpose of your life to either achieve union with God or to achieve awakening? So, does that explain to you why we're so mixed up?
Well, I guess what I'm wondering is why, is there any explanation as to why we're asleep?
Well, that is something that I have tried to address, but actually this relates directly. The answer to that is, that's one of those answers to which is held in the realm of Dharma causality. Why does it happen the way it happens? Why are we asleep to begin with? From the relative view, which is the view from the other four niyamas, especially from the physical, the biological, and the mental view. So, from that relative perspective, we can look at the evolution of the universe through time and say, well, it had to happen that way. See what I'm saying? Okay. And so, from the dharmic level of causality, it's going to answer that question as well, why it had to happen that way. But the answer from the dharmic level is, by its nature, going to be a much higher and more complete answer than the relative answer from the lower levels of causality. If you want to know the answer to why it had to happen the way it did, why are we born not awake, and why do we have to awaken? In a sense, I didn't know it at the time, and I couldn't have put it in those words, but that's the whole thing that I spent my whole life looking for, the answer to that question. Why is it the way it is? And part of my own personal process You know, I did spend some time in a Catholic seminary with the intention of becoming a priest. I got to a place where, you know, I was speaking from personal experience the other day when I said, you know, if you're an omniscient and omnipotent God, then why in the hell did you make such a mess of things? Because I really felt that. I dropped out of the seminary and I spent several years where I can best describe my attitude as being extremely angry at God. And but it's just because I didn't have the answers to those questions. But that's what I poured all my energy into looking for is the answer. Why is it the way it is? Why is it something rather than nothing is kind of the, you know, if you take all of these why kind of questions and you keep boiling them down simpler and simpler and simply, the one you end up with in the end is, why is there something rather than nothing? And the answers to those questions are held at the level of dharmic causality. The closest we can come from the lower levels of causality is, as I see, as I said, our perspective, limited as it is, to one of space and time, perceiving mind and matter like two sides of a coin that we can never look at both at once, and so on and so forth, then we just see it as the only way that the universe could have evolved. The universe pulls itself up by its own bootstraps from an undifferentiated mass of pure energy. The universe first had to make itself into the simplest components, and then it had to assemble those simpler components in more and more complex and sophisticated ways. And we are someplace on the journey that we can project at the end of is a totally realized universe that consists of purely of Buddha nature. And that just has to, that'll have to do as an explanation. as long as we're seeing things from this relative view, and it's not a bad way to see things, you know. But, yeah. So we have the privilege to be at a really important point where the physical evolution gave rise to the biological evolution, and biological evolution gave rise to the mind and mental evolution, and that brought us to the point of this karmic evolution. And so now we are privileged to be at this next point where through our understanding of karmic evolution that we can move to the next level. So I like to say that's we represent an opportunity within this maturing universe, an opportunity to become the level of spiritual evolution. But it's not like the universe has put all of its eggs in one basket, and if we don't pull it off, someone even better will come along and they'll pull it off. Because that's one thing about the way the universe pulls itself up by its own bootstraps, is it has enormous patience and it tries every possible combination until it gets the one that works. So if we're not fortunate enough to be, we're close to it, it can work on an individual basis. So So individuals can become awakened. Question is if we can do it on a larger scale. And if we can, universal, you know, like Edison and his, how many thousands of times he tried different filaments for his light bulb until he finally got the one that worked. It's kind of like that. If our light bulb goes out, the dharmic Edison will produce enough. Keep trying till it gets the one that works. That's how I see it. And that's only a way of thinking of it. It is empty, you know. It's just a conceptual model. But of course, some conceptual models work better than others. Does that answer the question of whose will is being addressed? Or whose will is being expressed at the atomic level of causality? If it suits anybody, for all of those people in the world for whom it suits to say it's the will of God, I'm totally with them. That's just as good a way to describe it as any other way. As long as you have a reasonable understanding of what that means. Okay, well, I think it's probably time to stop. And somehow or another, in one form or another, I think I've answered most of the questions that I started out with. Although I know that there's some of you where I didn't address your questions specifically. A few more meditation-related questions. But yeah, sometimes less is more. Oh, I'll just one last throwaway kind of here. Matthew mentioned you draw on emergence theory in your system. Can you briefly explain what that is? Sounds interesting. That's really what I'm talking about when I say that what we from our subjective point of view call our consciousness is a manifestation of something that is inherent in the universe at large. It's just that we see it from, you know, we see it. The idea of an emergent property is an example that's often used is the qualities of water. No one would ever be able to predict from an understanding of hydrogen gas and oxygen gas that if you combine the two together that you would have a substance with the qualities of water. So this would be an emergent property. But on the other hand, somebody who had just the kind of knowledge of physics and chemistry that we do now would actually be able to, if they knew enough about the properties of hydrogen molecules and oxygen molecules and hydrogen atoms and oxygen atoms and the various forces that hold the particles together and so on and so forth, they actually could predict the properties of water. So this is the idea of emergence. Is that something that would that something emerges at a higher level of complexity that is not evident at a lower level of complexity, but if you have enough knowledge, then that changes. that you can see where you can actually make the extrapolation. And that's what I say, the consciousness that we experience and that puzzles people so much. What is consciousness? What is consciousness? It's exactly the same thing that holds atoms and molecules and rocks and mountains together. So in that sense, it's already there in everything. The particular form that it emerges in human beings, if you don't understand what it really is, it appears to be this incredible mystery. How could an assemblage of matter ever result in something so totally different as consciousness? But then when you understand that indeed the very same thing that manifests as consciousness at this level of complexity is what's holding all that matter together in the first place, then it ceases to be a mystery. But we're not reducing mind to matter. What we're doing is we're studying one aspect of this non-dual stuff, and by examining it closely enough, we're starting to discern the laws and principles that that connect the other way that this stuff appears to us. Anyway, that's definitely enough. I will come back and talk to you tonight. There's a few meditation questions. I think they should be very brief. The main thing that I'm hoping to do this evening is just to talk to you about how to prepare for the end of the retreat, what to do afterwards. I've spoken to some of you in meditation interview about this, but need to talk to everyone about it. And depending on, I won't bother going into the other. There may be more tonight. I don't know. We'll see. Hmm. Okay. But there'll be that much for sure. I'll be back this evening to tidy up the last questions to do with meditation as much as I can. Thank you very much.